everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Are You Kidding Me? I'm Naomi Schaefer Riley, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute.
And I am Ian Rowe, also a senior fellow at AEI.
And today we are thrilled to be joined for our 100th episode, congratulations, Ian, by Rob Henderson. He is the author of a new memoir called Troubled, but you've probably heard of him long before that. He has an amazing column on Substack that we highly recommend. And he is also the person who coined the term luxury beliefs, which we're going to talk about later today. Welcome, Rob. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Naomi and Ian. Thanks for inviting me. Great to be here.
So I wanted to start just by talking a little bit about your background. For people who don't know, you grew up for the first several years of your life in the foster care system, and then you were adopted. Can you talk a little bit about first kind of your experience in the foster care system, and particularly what you think was kind of the biggest influence in terms of those early years on your thinking later on in life?
Well, so, you know, I was born into poverty in Los Angeles and never met my father. My mother became heavily addicted to drugs. So when I was three, I was placed into the LA County foster care system. And, you know, in terms of the emotions and the feelings, the phenomenological experience of it, living in seven different foster homes over the course of the next 5 years, it was mostly, you know, this combination of dread and anxiety, of constantly being moved to different homes, ranging, you know, anywhere from a few weeks all the way up to a year per home. There was a lot of instability, which cultivated those feelings, not knowing where I would live from, you know, week to week, month to month, but also, you know, I'd grow close with some of my foster siblings. And then one day I'd wake up and they would be gone because they would be, you know, relocated to another placement or returned to their family of origin. And, you know, of course, you know, those might have been good decisions, objectively speaking, but for little kids who constantly have to wonder where they're going to live and where the people around them are going to be, you know, it does cultivate this intense sense of dread and anxiety. And I get into the kind of statistics and the findings in my book about how detrimental instability is for childhood outcomes later in life.
What did that foundation lead you to believe? Because most kids who experience that kind of background, you know, aren't writing best-selling books later in life. So what was the pivot?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of different events that occurred later. So I was adopted just before my eighth birthday, and this was the late 90s. And so my adoptive parents, they were working class. It was a working class family. They had a biological daughter who became my adoptive sister, and we settled in this blue collar town in Northern California called Red Bluff. And, you know, I had been adopted at a time, I think, where, you know, family deterioration in kind of low income neighborhoods across the country, you know, this had been occurring for a while. But where I grew up, it was located in a poor county. It was kind of working class, lower middle class, mostly white with a large Hispanic population as well. And the families in this town were fragmenting and falling apart. And my adoptive parents, my adoptive father was a truck driver. My adoptive mom, she was an assistant social worker. And so they divorced about 18 months after the adoption. And, you know, in the book, I describe in detail the kinds of effects of instability and financial catastrophes and just so much turmoil and drama all throughout my upbringing. I thought after I had been adopted that things were going to turn around, and they really didn't. There was, you know, I'd lived a lot of life by the time I left home when I was 17. But the thing that really, I guess, what redirected my trajectory was enlisting when I was 17. And I describe in the middling chapters of the book, once I ship out for basic training and, you know, live within this very rigid structure, how beneficial stability was for me, this kind of stability that I lacked in the foster homes, in this working class community with my family that was fragmenting repeatedly, the friends around me in Red Bluff, California, who also came from similar kinds of family backgrounds, raised by single moms or by grandmothers or by people other than, you know, or in arrangements other than having two married parents. And so then, you know, there were some setbacks and some hiccups along the way when I was in the military, but eventually I landed at Yale on the GI Bill. And you know, this was a completely different kind of environment for me. I had anticipated that these students were going to come from very different economic backgrounds than me. But I wasn't fully prepared for the kinds of, I guess, sociocultural differences in terms of their family backgrounds, their early life experiences. I tell a story in the book about how at one point the professor administered this anonymous survey in one of my classes, and I discovered that 90% of the class had been raised by both of their birth parents, which just floored me. I don't know what I would have guessed in advance. I don't know if I would have guessed maybe 50%, 60%, something like that. But when it was 90%, and then I went in and dug through the data, and graduates of Ivy League universities overwhelmingly come from two married parents. Yeah. There's a massive sort of class divide here along family lines.
Yes. I mean, it's, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of people obviously associate any time in foster care with a kind of deep instability. But the question of the fact that these were being raised by both biological parents who were married to each other, presumably, you know, I think we underestimate how much the instability of divorce or, you know, as we talk about on this podcast a lot, just unwed motherhood has on kids, you know, that are not, you know, in the system or even close to being in the system. But that kind of instability also has an important and lasting effect on kids. So even once you were adopted and once you left that the public foster care system, you were still experiencing that kind of, you know, a lack of permanence and a sense of where am I going to be living next and who is really in charge of me on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that I point out in the book is that there's a, you know, developmental psychology, there's a distinction between childhood poverty and childhood instability. And what developmental psychologists find is that there's very little evidence that childhood poverty, you know, in the context of the U.S., has any predictive power in terms of childhood outcomes for incarceration rates, graduation rates, teen pregnancy, substance abuse, all those kinds of things. But childhood instability is a strong and reliable predictor across multiple studies. This has been replicated. And instability is measured by things like, you know, the questions they administer are things like, you know, were you raised by two married parents? Was there a divorce? How many different romantic partners did your primary caregiver have when you were growing up? How frequently did you physically relocate? Just how much day-to-day sort of disorder did you experience in your early life? And that has a strong and reliable connection with future dropout rates, incarceration rates, likelihood of substance abuse, you know, all the kinds of things that the social ills that we're all concerned about. And yet so much of the focus is on economics, on money, on poverty, which I wouldn't say those things are unimportant, but I think we spend a little too much time on that and less time on the stability factor. I mean, monogamous marriage, kind of that relationship commitment, even when you control for education and income, still has a very strong effect on childhood outcomes. Melissa Carney's recent book, The Two-Parent Privilege, she has some very interesting tables in there. And she actually doesn't spell it out in the text itself, which I thought was a shame. So I tweeted sort of interpreting these tables. Essentially, she finds that for a college-educated mother, if the mother is married, her child is twice as likely to go on to graduate from college as when a college-educated mother is unmarried. And the effect is even more pronounced for women who only have a high school education. So high school educated mothers who are married, their children are three times more likely to graduate from college than unmarried women with only a high school diploma. And so, you know, this is like clear evidence that marriage does have some kind of additive effect in terms of childhood stability, which then in turn leads to desirable social outcomes.
So let's talk about then this concept of luxury beliefs. You've shared this story where I think you were at the United Nations and it was a conference about family, and you spoke at length about the importance of marriage and
oh no, this was someone else. Sorry, this was someone else. But I was relaying this story that someone had experienced this. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, yeah. But afterwards, a speaker came up to you or to this person and said, you know, what you're saying is really right. Even in my own household, you know, I have a pretty stable, you know, the parents are together raising children. But I could never say this in public. Why does this happen in your view? Because you've coined a term that's obviously resonated, given the overwhelming data around the importance of marriage in particular, healthy marriages. And of course, we all have to concede that there are instances where there are marriages that are abusive. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about healthy marriages. Clearly, the data is overwhelming. Why mm-hmm. do you think it is the quote unquote elite class seems to diminish this clearly obvious structure that's good for kids, which they follow in their own lives, but don't espouse it for everyone else?
Yeah, I wondered about this. I used to think that it was primarily this kind of attitude of non-judgment that, you know, we live, you know, I formerly thought, oh, we live in this era of kind of moral relativism, you do you, that kind of thing. But then I've actually been immersed in kind of elite college environments for the last almost decade now. And I find that kind of upper middle class educated people are very willing to judge and condemn for things like recycling or attitudes around misogyny or homophobia or race and ethnicity and climate. And so they will strongly espouse sort of rigid moral views around those topics. But then, you know, when it comes to marriage, suddenly it is this kind of hands-off, either non-judgmental, or they go the opposite direction and say, actually, we need to move beyond marriage and that it's actually this kind of outdated structure. I'm not entirely sure why this is. I think part of it, so, you know, this is, eventually I came to believe that this was a kind of a marker of status. The whole luxury beliefs idea kind of arose as I was thinking about this. It confused me. I'm, you know, some days I'm more confident in this than others, but I do think the desire for recognition and esteem and distinction does play a prominent role here. Where, you know, if you look at the data and parse it by education level, the highest educated Americans are the most skeptical of marriage. If you ask them how, you know, is it important for a child to be raised by two married parents? People with college degrees are the least likely to agree with it. Something like 75% of college graduates say it's unimportant for a kid to be raised by two married parents, whereas the vast majority of Americans say that it is important. And so the luxury beliefs idea, ideas and opinions that confer status on the affluent while inflicting costs on the lower classes, you know, I think there is this drive towards if the masses, if conventional opinion is one way, then, you know, an avenue for you to stand out and to attain distinction is to essentially hold the opposing view. And here I'm drawing on a bunch of different sociological frameworks that I write about in the book and in some of my Substack essays. But there was this great book by Michael Knox Barron about WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And Barron writes about how a lot of the cultural elites of the mid-20th century, kind of what he termed the high WASPs, they would support certain ideologies and fashions and movements because it would abhor the vulgarians, that they expressed a kind of pleasure in the thought that, okay, well, you know, the masses will be upset by this, and it's kind of exciting to be transgressive and to be thrilling and you know, to sort of take a counterintuitive stance on a popular issue. And part of the reason is, you know, in my view, is that there is this drive for status, for recognition, prestige. It's a, you know, when you express a luxury belief like we need to move beyond marriage, you're sub-communicating that you probably attended an expensive college, you read the right kinds of fashionable periodicals, you move in a certain kind of social circle. When you take a very rigid stance on the aforementioned issues I mentioned before around recycling and climate and social attitudes and so on, those also sub-communicate the same thing. If you're very finicky about climate and recycling, you're also subcommunicating your education, your sociocultural background, and so on. So I think there is this kind of class status signifier around a lot of our kind of sociopolitical views.
And how do you think that then those attitudes amongst the elite, quote unquote, you know, sometimes we ascribe that word too freely. But how do you think that that then influences the cultural beliefs of people in lower income communities? So, for example, I run schools in the Bronx where the non-marital birth rate is 84.5%. What's the connection between those luxury beliefs and what happens in these communities?
Right. Well, I mean, if you look at the data around family formation over time, in 1960, 95% of American kids were raised by both of their birth parents, regardless of social class, ethnicity, background, and so on. And if you look at the upper classes, in the 1970s, they actually did start to have kids out of wedlock. And there was a spike in divorce rates and so on. But by the 1980s, they had reverted back to their 1960s baseline. And so it looks like they actually got high on their own supply and were actually living by the values they espoused. And then they came to their senses and realized this actually isn't a good way to live. But in the ensuing decade or two, that sort of reimagining of society was occurring, you know, the lower classes also received the message. In the early 1960s, attitudes around marriage, around family, around free love, and so on, and it was popularized in culture, in music, in movies, in you know, the attitudes of the elites. This is a pretty consistent and accepted finding in sociology that, you know, whoever is at the top of a social ladder or a hierarchy, they hold disproportionate power in terms of setting examples, in terms of the stories and the scripts that people aspire to. And so the lower classes, they adopted these views and they started to have kids out of wedlock too, stopped getting married and so on. And of course, there's an economic piece here as well that I'm kind of glossing over, but they were living by these values, and then they just never reverted back to their baseline. They just continued to fragment and deteriorate, because when you don't have resources, when you don't have education, when you don't have the same kinds of access to capital that the upper classes have, you know, when you remove these cultural guardrails, it becomes very difficult to sort of put Humpty Dumpty back together again, especially when the people who set the example for society and who wield a lot of influence in culture and politics, they aren't publicly willing to espouse the examples that they used to. I think, Naomi, when you and I had our lunch, I mentioned that I wanted us to return to this sort of old school form of elite hypocrisy, the
Yes.
kind of John F. Kennedy model, where, you know, back in the day, you know, John F. Kennedy would present himself as a good husband and a good father, and he would pay lip service to, you know, he thought it was important to set this example for the American public. And then privately, he was not a particularly great husband or father. But, you know, the elites at that time thought, okay, well, you at least have to sort of present this image because it's important to set
lip
that example.
Service is a kind of service.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. And now the elites almost go the opposite way, where at home they live by the conventional bourgeois values, but publicly they're espousing open marriage or polyamory or at the very least saying, you know, whatever family you want to form, and, you know, it's your decision, your call. I'm not going to get involved. I'm not going to make any kind of judgment one way or the other.
Yeah, well, I wanted to, one of the other sort of big luxury beliefs that I think people will take out of the book is people's attitudes toward drug use. And this is obviously something that you saw as having a very significant effect on the way you were raised, both in terms of one of the reasons that you were in foster care, and then also the reasons that, you know, so many people who were living around you as you were growing up had such kind of great difficulty essentially getting their acts together. You know, there's basically a very sort of growing acceptance, cultural acceptance, legalization, you know, a sense that drugs are really not the kind of harmful thing that all these, you know, puritanical types thought they were for years. You know, you really push back on this idea. I mean, it just in the context of the child welfare system, I think so often people are talking about, again, you know, poverty is really the root cause. But when you dig a little deeper, you see substance abuse is one of the things that really you know, prevents people both from, you know, earning an income and having stable housing, but also from, you know, raising their children, you know, in a responsible way. So can you talk a little bit about kind of, you know, that hypocrisy and how you see kind of the drug use that we're seeing in the United States, how that's playing out in families?
Yeah, well, you know, I just saw this coverage of what's happening in Oregon and how, so back in 2020, they decriminalized hard drugs, and now they're reintroducing legislation to recriminalize hard drugs, and they're realizing that experiment failed because people are overdosing and dying in the streets of Portland and elsewhere. And yeah, it's you know, I read this other recent story that the number of foster kids in the U.S. Has doubled since 2000. And this is in large part due to the opioid crisis and other sort of substance abuse related issues. Basically, you know, if you look at the reasons why kids go into foster care, overwhelmingly, it's either due to mental illness or addiction on the part of the parents. And which kind of makes sense because, you know, few parents would sort of in a state of clarity would choose to neglect their own child. But if there are sort of mental issues or if there's substance abuse involved, then suddenly they'll make choices that in a clearer frame of mind they would regret. And so, yeah, it's drug use is kind of a pastime. I think it's you can adopt this kind of libertarian attitude, I think, when it comes to you know, upper middle class neighborhoods. I have this line in the book that if you are a student or a graduate of an elite university, you can dabble, you can experiment. And even if your life does unravel, you have access to high quality healthcare and doctors and therapists and all these kinds of things who can help you wean yourself off of the drug. But for people in low income areas, it's much worse. They don't have the same level of access. Drugs are pervasive. And, you know, there are fewer avenues to achieve sobriety after the fact. And it's strange how popular this idea has grown. I mean, and sometimes I think that the sort of the legalization of marijuana, that was like a, you know, once that became a pervasive opinion, then that opened the door to every other kind of drug, which is not to say that I have an issue with marijuana legalization, but I do think like that was a kind of line that was being held, and now there is no line anymore. There was that book written by the Columbia professor, Carl something, a couple of years ago, defending recreational use of heroin and other drugs. A friend of mine at Princeton just texted me saying there's a new book out written by some other academic. It was like In Praise of Addiction, I think is the title. I don't know if it's out yet or if it'll be out later this year. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's worth looking into, but there's just another book. This is like a new kind of fashionable luxury belief. You know, it was like defund the police was the fashionable thing in 2020, 2021, and then they kind of pivoted. Polyamory was kind of this flash in the pan thing, and now I think we're sort of returning back to you know, a hard drug legalization. It's this interesting sort of rotating cycle of, you know, let's espouse these beliefs that make us look interesting and sophisticated, but
well, you could start combining effects. Them, you know, sort of, you know,
yeah. Drug, it's intersectionality,
fuel, polyamory, what
intersectionality,
I mean,
of luxury beliefs.
It's inter luxuriality. Maybe we've coined a new term. It's the inter luxuriality. So Rob, what's interesting to me is, okay, so you're now navigating in a world where, again, quote unquote, you're interacting with a lot of these so-called elites. What mm-hmm. happens when you actually confront them? Because I'm getting the sense you're now kind of becoming one of these authors like, oh, no, I've read Rob Henderson. I'm fully aware of these luxury beliefs. And yet they're not actually applying it to themselves. Are you finding that?
Yeah, to some extent. Yeah, I mean, that's like a very kind of common pattern. I mean, that's like a basic finding in psychology. We're all very good at self-deception of, you know, we learn something interesting about humanity and it applies to other humans, but never ourselves. right. And so, yeah, it's, I try not to, you know, be aggressive about it. I really have, you know, some of my sort of intellectual role models, you know, once I entered college and started to read a lot and think a lot, I mean, one of them would be someone like Jonathan Haidt. You know, just don't be aggressive, don't be impolite. And so, you know, I tried to take a sort of gentler approach with these things. But, you know, when the topic does come around to, I mean, I had these conversations here at Cambridge with American students, you know, fellow American doctoral students who believed in defunding the police. And I would sort of gently question them. And, you know, I would look for survey data and point out that why is it that the lowest income Americans are the least supportive? Why is it that when you look at Democratic voters, white Democrats are the most supportive of defunding the police? Like, what, you know, I'm curious what in your mind would explain something like this. And
yeah,
gradually,
and
I would
find that
for those
of our listeners who don't follow Rob on Twitter, he is always civil, and usually his tweets involve charts and lots of information that I think are, you know, sort of supposed to kind of get people to think. So he's, we appreciate the sort of non-combative nature, and hopefully the information that you're presenting is getting people to re-examine some of their ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I have had the occasional email sent to me from someone who, you know, they've explained how they've rethought some of their views, or, you know, they're reconsidering their opinion on, you know, a complete drug legalization, or yeah, other topics. I mean, I've had conversations with, you know, privately with tech executives who have expressed some degree of remorse for, you know, publicly selling addictive technologies while privately implementing very strict rules at home about screen use for their own kids. And so, you know, it does seem like people are, when they encounter my work, you know, some non-trivial number of people are rethinking their views.
They're rethinking their views privately, but not necessarily yet publicly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Give it time, Ian. Give it time.
Yeah, give it time. So, you know, we named this podcast, Are You Kidding Me? For this very reason, that there are often ideas that are put forth publicly, supposedly to help kids, but in fact, often do great damage. So I wanted to talk to you about one solution that I am often speaking about, which is teaching the success sequence in schools. And for our listeners, the success sequence is data which says if a young person completes just their high school degree, then gets a full-time job of any kind, just so they learn the dignity and discipline of work, and then if they have children, if they got married first, that series of decisions, education, work, marriage, and children, data shows 97% of millennials avoid poverty, and the vast majority enter the middle class or beyond. You can't prove causality, but it's a very high correlation. And yet there are those who, often espousing luxury beliefs, who say, no, we can't teach that in schools. You're trying to impose perhaps middle-class values. You'll insult these kids because many of their parents may not have followed that series of decisions in their own lives. How do we, in the real world, how do we confront luxury beliefs in such a way that we actually start to reverse these kinds of the impacts that these beliefs are now starting to have in low-income communities like this?
Well, you know, it's funny, the success sequence. I think when Naomi and I spoke at the that AEI event about my book, I did mention this survey I encountered, which found that among ordinary American voters, a roughly equivalent number of Democrats and Republicans supported teaching the success sequence in schools, something on the order of 70% of both Democrats and Republicans. But I noted that even though ordinary voters overwhelmingly support this, this is sort of a cross-partisan agreement. My strong suspicion is that there's going to be a very strong disagreement among Republican versus Democrat elites, where Republican elites probably would favor teaching this and Democrat elites would adopt that kind of more critical stance, maybe a sort of more luxury beliefs attitude about teaching this, which I find fascinating, you know, that it's a very simple set of steps and just about anyone, regardless of their ability, could follow it. I wrote about the success sequence in one of my Substack posts, and you know, I created this sort of, you know, alternate sequence where I suggested that, you know, what if researchers discovered that the only way to avoid poverty was to get a PhD in mathematics from MIT, work 100 hours a week, and practice lifelong celibacy? Then the correct response is that no one should be blamed for poverty, because just about practically no one could follow those three steps. But for the actual success sequence, almost anyone could follow them. I mean, graduating high school is easy. Like I was a horrible student, barely went to class. I think somewhere in my book, I don't know if I actually put this or I left this on the cutting room floor, I told stories about how I would spill Gatorade on my desk, clean it up with my homework, and then turn it in like a soaking wet piece of paper. And I would get a C- on the assignment. Teachers don't want to fail their students anymore. And so, yeah,
inflation plus the success sequence,
it may invalidate it. Yeah. Well, so yeah, I think, one of the things I try to do is to write, about the data, about how, something like this would be, broadly, agreed upon by American voters, presenting survey data indicating that low-income people, do support marriage when they for family formation. They do support, they are the most skeptical of legalizing hard drugs. So I'm drawing here on studies that I cite in my book. They are the so that would be interesting actually to look at support for the success sequence broken down by income or socioeconomic status or education level, because my strong suspicion is that it would be like more educated, more affluent people who would take a critical stance, and lower income people who would think, oh, that's just common sense.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. In fact, years ago, I was in a classroom of ninth graders in New Orleans, almost all low-income kids. And I at that time, I was getting lots of pushback in New York City for teaching the success sequence in our schools. And I shared this with these ninth graders, almost all low-income, almost all Black, Hispanic, and Asian kids. And I shared with them that I was having all these struggles. And once they understood it, they said, what are you talking about? Why wouldn't you teach that to us? Of course we'd want to know. Why would you deprive us of that information?
Yeah.
A lot more useful than a lot of the other things they're going to learn in school. So
there you go. Exactly.
A lot more practical application. All right. Well, those are all the questions that we have. Actually, we have lots more questions for you, Rob, and we could talk all day. We really appreciate your coming on today. Everyone should go and read your new book, Troubled, A Memoir of Foster Care, Family, and Social Class, and check out your Substack. So with that, we want to thank you. You can get episodes of Are You Kidding Me on the AEI podcast channel or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Naomi Schaefer Riley.
And I'm Ian Rowe. Rob, thank you. Your work is so important.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Naomi. This has been great.